in telling the deer hunting stories, I want to start with the time when Sue phoned me when she was raising her family and said that she remembered that when they were little, we never told them fairy tales or bedtime tales. I always told them deer hunting stories and how much she'd enjoy them. And she asked me if I would make a tape of all the hunting stories that she could play for her children. I agreed to do it. And so for several weeks in traveling between Salt Lake and Provo, I took a tape recorder along and recorded as many hunting stories as I could remember. So when Becky and I decided to work on my life story and to record it, I called Sue and asked if she would send that tape back to me so that I could make some copies of it. Unfortunately, over the years, the tape's been lost. And so these hunting stories that I'm recording now are the best that I can remember. And I'm sure that there's many, many that I just don't remember. But we'll start with the first. I had never been hunting in my entire life. My father never hunted. He did have a revolver, as he had been a sheriff's deputy and a police officer. And I can remember sometimes traveling to the ranch or to Elsinore, and Dad would have the gun in the car and a jackrabbit would cross the road and he'd stop the car and shoot at it. I never remember him getting one, but he may have done. I just don't remember. But after I'd had my first year at BYU, I had a job at the Utah Builder Supply as a sheet metal worker's helper. And there's another young man in the same position, the sheet metal worker's helper. His name was Monty Young, and we became good friends. When it came time for deer hunting, all of the mechanics in the shop were talking about going deer hunting, and Mont and I decided that we ought to go deer hunting, but we were low men on the totem pole, and so we had to stay in the shop that Saturday morning that the deer season started. So our deer hunt didn't start till late afternoon, the Saturday of the opening. Mont and I both purchased Model 96 Winchester carbines, 30-30 caliber. I got mine from Sears. Vivian's sister, Kathy, was working there, and I got the gun for $19. They sell now for about $295 new. We had Mont's dad's car all packed with our sleeping bags, a tent, our guns, our ammunition, our food, before we went to work that Saturday morning. So as soon as the clock said 12 o'clock, we punched the time clock and jumped in the car and drove up Parley's Canyon over to Colville, where we turned east off the main road up Chalk Creek. We had talked to a lot of people, and they had agreed that this was a good place to hunt deer. Neither one of us had ever been there before. Neither one of us had ever been deer hunting. And we really didn't know much about it except what we'd learned from talking with the mechanics in the shop who were hunters who'd had several years' experience. We were driving up the canyon. I found a place that looked like a good place to stop. So it was about 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and Mont and I grabbed our guns, and we had Mont's girlfriend's brother with us. And we left him there to take care of the car and the stuff while we were gone, and we started climbing the mountain. And we got up the top of the ridge and got down to the bottom of the other side. There was a road going up there, and a man came running up the road and says, "Come help us, we're chasing a great big buck." We looked around, we couldn't see any sign of any big buck, so we declined to go with him. And there was a quite large ravine ahead of us, and we decided Mont would go up the left side of the ravine, I'd go up the right side, and we'd meet on top. When I got up on top, I couldn't find Mont anywhere, and I called, no answer. So I decided I'd gotten to the top before he did, and I crossed over to his side and started back down. I'd gone down about, maybe 300-400 yards, and I heard something, and I turned around and looked. There was the big buck standing in the oak brush watching me. And I had been taught how to shoot in the ROTC at high school. So I very slowly turned around, pulled my gun up to my shoulder, and the hunters at the shop had told me the best place to shoot a deer is in the neck, close to where it comes off the shoulders. So that's where I placed my shot, pulled the trigger, the deer went down. First time I go deer hunting, the first deer I see, I get with the first shot. And this turned out to be the biggest deer that I ever had in all of my hunting career. It had 6 points on one side, 7 points on the other, and a spread, as I recall, and this is on memory only, no guarantees, about 35 or 36 inches. It was a beautiful head. At the time, I was dating Vivian Poole, and her brother Harold was a taxidermist, and he thought the head was such a beautiful head that it deserved mounting, so he mounted it for me. I helped him, but my help was minimum. He did most of the work. And we had the head in our home in Sandy until Bradley set the house on fire. In the room the head was in, and it got burnt so badly I threw it away. And I've always regretted that I didn't at least cut the horns off and save them. But the head itself was beyond repairing or having. After the deer was down, I reached for my hunting knife so I could cut its throat and bleed it and start taking out the entrails. And I didn't have a knife with me. The knife was back in the car. I could have cried. So I started back down the mountain, get back to the car and get a knife, come back and find the deer. Well, first I started to drag the deer down the mountain. And it was a big deer, and I drug it as far as I could. And it was downhill all the way, and it just got to be more than I could handle. So I left the deer and started for the car. And as I got to the bottom of the hill, I found Mont and told him what had happened. So we went back to the car, got Mont's girlfriend's brother, whose name I've forgotten, got our knives and started back. By now it's dark. We had our flashlights. We climb up the mountain, we hunt, and we look, and we can't find the deer. And it was really discouraging. Decided we just have to come back in the daylight. So we were going down the hill, and I was in the lead, and I was flashing my light back and forth to see where to go, where the best trail was. And I came across the path of something being dragged down, and I turned my light downhill, and there was my deer. And it was just sheer luck that we found it. So Mont and I cut the throat, got the deer opened up and the entrails all out of it, and then the two of us drug it down to the road, and it was really a hard job for the two of us. It was such a big deer. We got to the road and it started down the road, and we just stopped to rest when a man came along in a pickup truck, stopped, and looked at our deer and complimented us on what a big one it was. And he helped us put it in his truck. Mont and I couldn't lift it up into the truck by ourselves. He helped us and put it in his truck and drove us to camp and helped us get the deer hung up in the tree. Let me tell you, I slept good that night. I was so tired. And the next day was Sunday. Mont and I went out hunting in the morning. We didn't ever see another deer. Neither one of us ever fired a shot. We went back and got the deer loaded on the fender of the front wheel on the passenger side of his dad's car, then started back down to Salt Lake. We're going down Provo Canyon, and a highway patrolman pulls up behind us and turns on his siren and his lights, and Mont pulls over, and the guy gets out of the highway patrol car and comes over to us, and Mont says, what was I doing, officer? And the highway patrolman says, oh, you're not doing anything illegal, son. I just wanted to see that deer. That's the biggest one I've ever seen. And so he admired the deer a little, and we got in the car and brought it home. We got to our house on Bryan Avenue. We got it into the garage, and Dad helped us hang it up, and then Mont and I skinned the deer out, and I cut it right down the backbone, cut it right in half, and gave half to Mont. And the other half, the next day, Dad and I took to a butcher that lived in our Whittier ward, and he cut it up and packaged it for us, and that was the first venison I had ever eaten. As far as I know, it was the first that my siblings had ever eaten. My parents had both had it before. That was the first hunt, and all the hunts I had and all the deer I killed, that was the largest. And I regretted I didn't find some place to get it weighed and see how much it weighed. I regretted that I didn't keep the skin and have it tanned. The next deer I hunt I can remember is I was home from the mission field, and I can't remember. I think I was in the service. I'm sure I was in the service, and I was home on furlough between transfer. And it was deer hunting season, and my brother Ralph and I went deer hunting up East Canyon off Parley's Canyon. And we drove up one afternoon and set up camp. Neither one of us had decent sleeping bags. And we were so cold, we couldn't get to sleep. So we finally decided that we'd put one sleeping bag inside the other and we'd both get in the same bag. And then we slept warm enough that we got some sleep. The next morning, we got up and we started up a ravine the way Mott and I had done, with Ralph on one side and me on the other. And Ralph got higher up on the mountain than I did. And he all of a sudden, he shouted at me, "Glenn, look out, there's deer down there." And I hadn't seen or heard anything, but I looked around and I saw several does. And of course, we had buck permits. And I sat down and watched. The deer were moving slowly up the bottom of the ravine. And a two-point buck came in. And that's about the way it would be in those that time of year. The big bucks would be with them, would be herded up together. The does and young bucks would be together. So after several does and fawns had gone by, this two-point buck came by, and I got my second deer with my first shot that year. In 2 years, I had two deer, two shots. Ralph came down, and we cleaned it out, and drug it down to camp. Ralph said he didn't want to stay another day, so we loaded it up and came home. The third time I went deer hunting was after the war. Uncle Harold was home, and Harold and I and three or four of Harold's friends went deer hunting up on the Deseret Ranch property out of Woodruff, Utah. And we went up the day before and set up a camp, a pretty nice camp. Harold and I had a tent of our own, and they brought nice food and good food, and we all pitched in and had good meals. It was a real nice camp. And the next morning, we got out and separated and decided, each one decided which way they wanted to go. And Harold and I went southwest of where the camp was. And we got up on top of a pretty high ridge and decided that Harold would go down one side, I'd go down the other. Maybe we'd scare something up. I got separated from Harold. I don't know where he went. I couldn't find him. So I just kept hunting around. I knew where camp was. I wasn't lost. I knew where camp was. I just kept hunting, and I'd sit and rest and watch the mountains, watch the open spaces. I never did see any deer at all. So finally, it was late afternoon. I decided it was time to work my way back to camp. And I started back to camp, and I was approaching a saddle in the ridge, and I saw a deer come over the mountain. And we had doe permits this time, and it happened to be a doe. And I just watched it. I just sat down as soon as I saw it, got my gun up to my shoulder, and just kept the sights on it. It kept getting closer and closer and closer. And I don't know whether it saw me or something spooked it, but it turned and started back the way it had been coming down, and I shot and got it down. And as I recall, it was the first shot again, but I'm not sure about that. But anyway, Harold heard my shot. He came over the hill, and he hadn't seen any deer at all, but he helped me clean this one out, and we hauled it back to camp. And I remember the next day we went hunting, and some of the fellows had gotten deer, some hadn't, and I don't remember who and what, but in the late afternoon we decided we'd go to a different place, and so we all got in the back of one of the trucks, and we were driving down this road going over to a different area to hunt, and we ran into a herd of about 25 deer. It was just amazing, and they were just crossing the road ahead of us. And everybody jumped out and started shooting, and I think the whole bunch of us had buck fever. We just were shooting. We weren't aiming our guns. Nobody got a single deer out of that. They all got away. I've thought of that many times. I shot several times, but I don't ever remember taking aim and shooting. But I had my deer for that hunt, and that was the third time. Now, after this, there's some more stories I can tell, but I make no claims to chronological order. I don't remember when they happened. Some I remember happening when we lived in Lehigh, some in Sandy, etc., but I have no idea about the chronological order. One hunt I do remember was with LeVar Bateman. He and I went back up to Chalk Creek, and we parked fairly close to where Monty and I had parked the same the first year we came up there. And we had our camp all set up the day before, and morning of the hunt we got up and went out, climbed the mountain. It was called the Strawberry Area. Strawberry Ridge. We climbed it in the dark with our flashlights, and then we got up on top and sat there as it got lighter, watching for deer. We saw some too far away to shoot at, but we didn't see anything to shoot at. So after we'd sat there through the morning and hadn't seen anything come close, we decided to get out and move around, maybe stir something up. It so happened that I had a call from Mother Nature, and so I left LeVar waiting for me, and I went around into some trees and was answering the call of Mother Nature, and here came a big buck, not 20 yards away from me. I dropped my pants, I grabbed my gun, and I shot once. I only got one shot at it, and it didn't even stop. As soon as I moved, it took off running. Ran right over in front of LeVar Bateman, and he got it. I think he shot two or three times, but he killed the deer. So I finished my business and went over to see what if he'd got. I'd heard him shooting, and I knew the deer was going in his direction. I knew what he was shooting at, so I got over there, and he was just starting to clean the deer out, so I helped him clean it out, and we took it back down to camp. The next morning, we went out, and We were up on top early morning like we'd been the day before. Didn't see anything, so we decided to hunt down the ridge towards camp, but lower in the canyon than the camp was. When we got to the road, we'd have to go up the road to camp, but we were going down, and I said to LeVar, you know, I think this kind of weather, we got a better chance up high. I think we ought to go up high, we haven't been over in this area. He said, well, I've got my deer. If you want to do that, that's fine. He said, but I'm just too tired to climb that mountain again. I said, well, wait right here for me. If you see anything, go ahead and shoot it for me. But I'm going to go up. So I climbed up to the top of the ridge. And on the other side, there was a large, flat sagebrush area. No oak brush, no trees, just a good stand of sagebrush. I guess some of it was at least waist high. And the other side of that was some quaking asp. And I thought, well, I'm going to go down there through those quaking asp. Maybe I'll get something. And I just started into the sagebrush, and a buck jumped up not 10 yards ahead of me. He'd been there all the time I was standing there looking around. But till I came towards him, he didn't move. Then he jumped up and took off on the run. And hit a deer running is a good shot. And I shot several times, but the deer got into the quaking asp, and I didn't get one. That was 1 year I failed. But we'd had a good time, and it was nice that LeVar got the deer. Another deer hunt I remembered was when Harold and Diane's Harold and his brother Tom and myself went down to Mona on a postseason hunt. It was late in the year, and we had buck permits in the Mona area. And so we got down there early, and we climbed up in the dark, got pretty high on the mountain. And Harold, Uncle Harold, your mother's brother, and I think we had Craig with us. I think he and Craig went on ahead, and Tom and his son and I went up a different direction, and all of a sudden Tom says, "There's a deer." I said, "Where?" Tom was just along for the trip. He didn't have a license, a gun, or permit, or anything. So he tried to point it out to me. That was before I'd had the cataract removed from my eyes, and I couldn't see the deer. I looked, and he pointed, and he looked. Finally, he says, "Well, here, give me the gun. Let me shoot it." And nothing doing. This is my permit. I'm going to shoot the deer. There's one over there. It's over there. And he kept pointing. Finally, I saw the deer. It was a long ways away. So I sat down, and the deer was just moving slowly through the oak brush. And I waited until it got to an open space. And as it stepped out into the open space, I shot, and down it went. And I asked Tom, I said, "Now, you know where the deer is. I'm going over to it, but I'll get lost. I won't be able to find it unless you can direct me which way to go. So don't lose the deer. Keep your eye on it until I found it." And I went over where I thought it would be, and Harold's brother Tom yelled, pointed farther down the mountain, and I was going down, he yelled to stop, and then motioned for me to come towards him, and I did, and then I found the deer, and I cleaned it up. By the time they got over there, I'd had it all bled and cleaned out. He helped me carry it down the truck. Then we went back to find Uncle Harold and Craig, and they had a nice deer down. And so that was the two permits filled. We went down, got back the same day with our deer. Later, many years later, I was talking with Diane's Harold about that particular deer hunting trip. And he says, "Yes, Tom told me," he says, "your father-in-law can't see worth a damn, but he can sure shoot straight." When I was in the mission field, my district president's name was Alva Snow, and he and I really hit it off well. He was a good man, and I liked him. And by this time, he'd graduated from college at Utah State, and he was working in Roosevelt. He and his wife and family were there. And so he had invested in a big old tire store in Salt Lake, and his brother was running it. And when I found out that Alva Snow owned it, I did my tire business there. And one time I was in the store, and Alva was there, and I invited him to go deer hunting with us. And he said he'd really like to go, so we made arrangements. We'd meet in Colville. There was LeVar Bateman and his friend Jim, not sure it's Jim, his last name was Gibbs, but you called him Gibby. And from LeVar's from Lehigh, Gibby was from Springville, Harold was from Salt Lake, and I was from Sandy. And we met in Colville. Alva Snow came down. We all drove up Chalk Creek. And the day before, the hunt was done. We went a little farther up the canyon this time. We were still on Strawberry Ridge, and set up our camp, and had a good dinner and went to bed early. Got up early in the morning, and went out hunting. We separated. Each one of us took a different path, and I got to the top of the ridge that I was had chosen to go to, and sat down, and hadn't seen anything, and it was getting later in the day, and I just about decided to move when I heard Harold yell, and Harold was on a across the gully, across the ravine from me, quite a ways away, but he and three of the others, and I don't remember which three they were dragging two deer. And Harold kept pointing down below me. And I finally realized that he could see some deer that I couldn't see. So I started moving very slowly, very carefully, trying not to make noise so that I'd spook them. And I saw these three big bucks. And I didn't know what to do. I knew I wanted to shoot one, but should I try to get two of them if somebody else didn't have their deer? I finally decided I'd try to get somebody else's deer. I'd get mine and somebody else's if I could. So I shot one of them, and of course the other two took off running. And matter of fact, it took me two shots. The first one hit the deer I was aimed at, and it slowed it down. It wasn't running very fast. Then I shot it and dropped it. The other two deer were quite a ways away at that time, and I shot two or three times, but I didn't come close, apparently. And it was a good thing I didn't, because by that evening, all five of us had our deer. All five of us had shot our own deer. We hadn't had to shoot one for each other. And Uncle Harold took a picture of us with our deer hanging up from Alvis Snow's truck. I think it was Alvis. And submitted the picture to the Deseret News, and they ran it in the paper. Gene Gibbs. Yeah, that's right, Gene Gibbs. And then there's another picture that was put in the newspaper that Harold took that shows Harold and LeVar and Gene Gibbs and myself with four big bucks. And I just don't remember much about that trip. But it was a successful one. We got our picture in the paper and we got our deer. And they're all nice big ones too. And in the newspaper report of this four bucks, the four hunters, said that we all had our deer by 9 a.m. that day. Oh, that's great. I should have remembered that one, but I don't. Another hunt Harold and I went on was a postseason hunt up in the Manila area in the northeast corner of Utah. To get to it, we had to go drive into Wyoming along what's now Interstate 15. It was, I think, I-80 in those days, something. Or anyway, 89 or something. Anyway, we drove quite a ways into Wyoming, past Rock Springs, then we turned south, came back into Utah. And we drove up the morning the hunt opened. We started about midnight, Uncle Harold's place. We had my Pontiac station wagon. And we weren't planning to stay overnight. We were just planning to go up for the one day. And the reports were that the deer were really, really plentiful. So we go up and we hunt. And about noon, I get a nice buck. And so we dress it and put it in the car. We haven't set up camp or anything. We just put it in the back of the station wagon. And Harold and I hunted and hunted and hunted. And we never did get a shot. We saw some deer, but they were a long ways away. We never get a shot. So we're coming home. It's dark. It's night. I have no idea whether we're in Utah or Wyoming. And two big bucks just trot across the road, this dirt road in front of us. I said, "Harold, grab your gun." He grabbed his gun and opened the car door and shot one of them. And then we went over, we cut the throat, and then we saw a car coming down the road, and we didn't know whether we were in Utah and Wyoming. We didn't know if we were legal or not. So let me tell you, you've never seen a deer jump from the road into the car as fast as that one got into that car. We just threw it in, grabbed the doors and shut them, and turned our lights on and started down the road, waved at the other car as we passed it. Hopefully it wasn't game wardens. One of the things I enjoyed about hunting with Uncle Harold is he is one of God's noblemen. He is a very, very special person. And because of his experience in World War II of being a prisoner of the Japanese, he has shared with me some of the experiences that he had as a prisoner. As far as I know, I'm the only person that whom he has shared some of them. Many of the others he's shared with the media, with the newspapers, radio and television, and they're heartbreaking. He tells about the death march, when if a fellow stumbles and fell, he's liable to be bayoneted in the back by a Japanese because he's holding up the procession. They were dying of thirst, they were hungry. They'd pass a stream of water, and they'd look around to see if there were any guards close. If there were, they'd just go by. If there weren't any guards close, they'd grab their canteens and jump in the stream and try to get as much water as they could. The cruelty was just unbelievable. While he was in the Philippines, one of his good friends was a prisoner with him, and he got quite sick and was giving up, and Harold was trying to get him to keep fighting. You didn't keep fighting, you would die. And he says, "Oh, if I could just have a decent meal, just something to eat, maybe I could keep fighting." So Harold, at night, digs a trench, digs a hole underneath the fence of the prison camp, and goes out into the Filipino village and trades something, I don't remember what, for some fish, fresh fish. And he comes back and builds a little fire in the shadows where they can't be seen, and cooks these fish and takes them into his friend in the hospital. And the man was really grateful for them, really appreciated them, and enjoyed the meal. And Harold told me, he says, "One of the hardest things I've done in my life is not eat that fish myself. We were so hungry and we were given so little food." But his friend died anyway. And after the war was over and Harold was home, this man's parents came to visit Harold and talk to him about their son and if Harold knew where he was buried. Harold was ultimately transferred to Japan, and he said the conditions in the ship that they were sent to Japan in were unbelievable. There was no bunks or place to sleep. They were just in a big open hold. There were so many of them that only half of them could sit down at a time, and then they're leaning up against each other, and the other half are standing. Then they take turns standing and sitting. And they were really weak. They had very little food, very little drink on the ship. Things were better when they got to the prison camp in Japan, but not a lot better. The Japanese officers demanded absolute strict on the minute obedience from prisoners and their soldiers alike. Harold saw a Japanese officer cut off a Japanese soldier's head because he had been slow obeying an order. Some of the things Harold told me, I just don't ever repeat. I don't even like to think about them. But a very interesting thing is that they knew the war was over because American bombers were coming over. And the American bombers would come down, fly low over the prison camps and drop them food and things. And so they knew the war was about over. I guess before I get to that point, I ought to mention that they were working in a foundry. And it was a steel plant. That's what it was, and they were making steel. And they had the old Bessemer converter-type furnaces, and the prisoners would take a wheelbarrow load of coke and a wheelbarrow load of iron ore and a wheelbarrow load of scrap steel up a ramp to the top of the furnace and dump it in, then come down a different ramp. And not Harold, but one of the prisoners found a piece of fire brick, and he put it in his wheelbarrow load and dumped it in the top of the furnace, and the piece of fire brick worked its way down to the nozzle of the furnace, the opening at the bottom, and plugged it up. And so they had to let the fire go out, let the steel harden. It put that furnace out of commission for the rest of the war. And he said, we were frequently doing things like this. Harold said another time they were unloading ships on at the harbor, and they were unloading beans, and these beans were just in big holds. And what they do is they take a gunny sack or a sack of some sort down into the hold, shovel it full of beans, and carry it out. And so the second day they weren't sent to that job, every one of the prisoners wore two pair of pants, and they tied inside pair around their ankles. And when they'd go down in the hold, they'd fill up their sack full of beans, then they'd fill up the pant legs of the inside pants and take the beans back to the prison camp for extra food. One of the best things that Harold told me, and that I've never forgotten, is that he came back from Japan with an intense dislike for the Japanese government and the Japanese military, and an absolute love for the Japanese people. He said, we would have starved in those prison camps if the Japanese peasant women, knowing we were starving, would smuggle food into us. He said, if they got caught, they'd have been killed. But they took that chance, and they cared that much about their fellow people that they were willing to take the chance to see that we got fed. And an interesting thing is that Harold's son went to Japan on a mission. I have to tell you one more experience. Harold and I were walking down 3rd South in Salt Lake City between Main and State Street. And at that time, there were two separate grocery stores on the north side of the street. And both of these grocery stores had outside bins on the sidewalk that they'd fill with produce and then take inside at night. And this was, Harold must have been home 6 or 7 months from his prison camp, and I'd been home close to a year. Anyway, I was walking on the outside, and Harold was walking inside, closest to the stores. And we got to one store, and a potato had rolled off the rack and was just balanced on the curb. And Harold saw that out of the corner of his eye, and he just shoved me aside and dove on that potato. And then he was so embarrassed. He said, I can remember we prisoners fighting for orange peels when we'd see them in the road or on the street. And that was just a nervous reaction when I saw that potato. I didn't think, I just dove for it. And it didn't matter who was in my way. One time, Harold and Harold's friend, and I don't remember his name, and I went down to Mount Nebo on a postseason hunt. And this friend of Harold's wasn't an experienced hunter, and he felt like he ought to stay close to Harold. That was all right by me. I didn't mind a bit. We got there in the early morning, and climbed up the mountain. At the same time we were on a postseason deer hunt, the elk season was open on Mount Nebo. And we'd climbed up pretty high, and I'd separated from Harold and his friend. I didn't know where they were, but I hadn't seen any sign of deer or anything. So after I got the top, I crossed over, started down the other side, the side towards the valley. I could see Nephi and Mona, all the areas. And I was going down, there's two fellows sitting on a rock, and I come by them. They said, "How you doing?" I said, "Well, I'm having a lot of hunt, no shoot. Are you after deer or elk?" "I'm after deer. What are you guys after?" "Well, we're after elk, and we haven't seen any elk, but we sure seen a lot of deer." "Where?" "Right around here." "Oh, you're kidding." "No, I'm not kidding. We've seen quite a few deer. We got buck or doe permits." "We got buck permits, my friends and I." He says, "Well, if you want to just sit here and wait, I think you'll see some." So I waited a little while, and then I decided I'd walk on down. And I'd gone down maybe 100 yards or so, and then I saw three nice bucks, medium-sized bucks, sneaking through the brush, going up the mountain when I was coming down. I think they'd heard me coming, and they got over away from me, trying to go around me up the mountain. So I thought of, if I shoot at the first one and miss, I'll have a better chance of getting another shot at the second or third one. So I shot at the first one and missed him completely. He took off on the run, and the second one jumped and turned and looked at me, and while he was standing still, I got him. And so I went over and cut his throat, opened him up, cleaned him out. I was dragging him down when Harold and his friend came along, and they hadn't seen anything or heard anything at all. That's another one of the hunts. I remember several hunts out in the Skull Valley area. I remember going out hunting. I don't remember what happened, whether we got deer or not. When we lived out at the Desert Chemical Warfare Depot, we hunted out that way. And I do remember the very first time I went duck hunting. Harold and several of his friends and myself all had post-season permits for this Skull Valley area. So we'd gotten up early and driven out there, and we'd hunted till noon, and none of us had seen a deer. And these other guys all wanted to go duck hunting because noon was the opening of duck season. So we decided, all right, no deer, we'll go duck hunting. So I'd never been duck hunting in my life, but we had planned to go that year. Harold had convinced me, so I bought a duck stamp. So we all go home, and I didn't own a shotgun at that time. But Harold said I could borrow his dad's double-barrel shotgun, so we go get our guns. We all go out to Farmington Bay. And man, the ducks were flying everywhere. I couldn't hit one. I shot and shot and shot. And so it was getting late, and we were about ready to go home. And a flock of ducks came over, and I raised my gun to shoot. And one of the fellows says, "Don't shoot them. They're fish ducks." I just, "Look, I haven't hit anything yet, and they're safe," and I shot and got one. And fish ducks you don't eat. They don't, they're not very tasteful, and they eat fish. But I took the duck home and gave it to Harold to mount for his collection. He didn't have a fish duck in his collection. That was the first duck I saw, and maybe that ought to lead into the duck hunting stories. I remember one time Grandpa Poole and Harold and I were out at Farmington Bay, and the season opened at noon, and we were out on the far dike. We were about 50 yards apart, and the season opened about 15 minutes before noon, the way it always did, but we saw these three geese get up off the water and turn to fly out to Great Salt Lake, where they would be safe. And somebody shot at them, and they turned and they came down the dike, flying parallel to the dike. And they came by Grandpa Poole first, and he shot one of them. I shot the second one and Harold shot the third one. We had our geese permit filled. We got some ducks too that I'll never forget, those three geese coming right down by us. One thing about shooting ducks was Uncle Harold helped me, was shooting clay pigeons. He'd take me out and throw clay pigeons for me to shoot at and help me. So I learned to shoot shotgun. Grandpa Poole hunted and fished a lot. He was a bird hunter. He never went deer hunting or elk hunting, anything like that with us, but he would go duck hunting, and he was a good shot, too. He had a double-barrel shotgun, and he was a good shot. I remember at least two or three times, Harold and I and Grandpa Poole out at Ogden Bay or Farmington Bay, either one, and Grandpa Poole would have more ducks than either one of us. Becky's just asked me, tell about the which hunts the hunting like best, pheasants or ducks or deer. I did go elk hunting a few times, but I never had an opportunity to shoot an elk. I had six cow elk come by me one time, not 10 yards away from me, but I couldn't shoot at them, but it was a thrill just to see them come so close to me. I love deer hunting, and I love the venison. I love the venison mostly because of the way Vivian would cook it. And as I recall, and I don't know what spices she had, but she had a flour mixture with some spices, and she'd pound this into the venison steaks and then roast them. They weren't fried in a frying pan. They were put in a roaster and roasted. And man, they were delicious. And Harold Poole's wife, Kathleen, couldn't stand venison. She just wouldn't eat it at all. And one day they were at our house, and we hadn't expected them for dinner, but we were having dinner, and so we invited them to eat with us. And Harold knew what we were eating. We were eating venison. And he passed the word not to say it to Kathleen. And she enjoyed it, thought it was just delicious. And as far as I know, she was never told that she'd eaten venison. But she enjoyed that. Oh, I remember one deer hunt we went up to, Raft River Mountains in the northwest corner of Utah. And the previous year we'd gone up there, I'd gotten a doe. It was a postseason permit, and there were too many deer for the range, and so they were wanting us to kill off the does. So I'd gotten a nice doe, and Harold had gotten one too. So the next year we thought we'd go up there in that same area on the opening. And so we got everything ready, and Craig and Daryl were with me, Uncle Harold, Uncle Russ was there. We got there and we got our camp all set up. And we were up in the mountains. We were a long way off the road, and it started to snow. And we were huddled around the fire keeping warm, but we were really concerned of getting, so we might get snowed in. Finally, we decided that it wasn't worth taking the chance. We better get out of there. So we broke camp and came home. And I can remember driving around the back of the house there in Sandy. There was Vivian sweeping out the back hall, the back door. She was really surprised to see us. It hadn't snowed at all down there, but up where we were, it had really snowed. I remember one time Harold and Russ, Ken and I went down to Monticello on a postseason hunt. One of us knew somebody from Monticello, and he'd given us some places to go where he felt we had a good chance to get deer. And on the way down, Russ's gun got put down on the seat in the van and somebody sat on it. Russ was really ruined that the barrel had been bent. I've never forgotten how upset he was. He bent the barrel of his gun. And I can't remember whether we got deer. I think we did get some deer, but I just don't remember for sure. I remember that's the farthest we'd ever gone on a deer hunt was down to Monticello. One time we had I had a postseason permit for the north side of the Uintas. I just can't remember the name of the town that was by, but anyway, we went out there, and I took Becky and Craig with me. We hunted most of the morning and hadn't seen anything, and it was cold. It was just bitter cold, and so we didn't have any matches. None of the three of us had any matches, so I said, well, I'll show you how you build a fire when you don't have any matches. I took one of my rifle shells and put the lead in the end of the barrel and pried it off the shell. Then I carefully poured the powder out of the gun shell onto a pile of leaves and some little sticks, and then I took my revolver and shot my revolver into this pile of gunpowder, and it caught fire. The leaves caught fire, the sticks caught fire, and we kept adding bigger sticks and wood, and soon we had a fire and warmed up. I remember getting a doe on that trip. I remember taking Sue duck hunting with me once, and that was the last time she ever went. Sue and her boyfriend, Lee Gunnell. That's the only reason she went, I'm sure. She gave me to understand she didn't plan to go again. One of the duck hunts I went on, I took all three of my sons. And I can't say that I never hunted on Sunday, but I did. And but this particular time, we went out on a Saturday and made it just for one day. Went up to Ogden Bay. And it was winter weather. It was cold. But I had no problem with it. I was comfortable. I didn't even have my gloves on because it's harder to shoot with gloves than not. And the kids were just having a ball watching the other hunters and watching me and retrieving the ducks. When they'd drop in the water, you just have to watch them till they got close enough to the bank that the kids could hit them with a stick and pull them in. And then when it come time to go home, Bradley was so cold that I gave him my coat. And that particular hunt is memorialized with a picture of us at the home in Sandy with all of us holding up a whole string of ducks. And Bradley's wearing his coat and my hunting coat too. When we lived in Lehigh was the first time I went pheasant hunting, and LeVar Bateman, of course, had lived there all of his life and had been pheasant hunting, and he knew the area, and he took us up on his dry farm pheasant hunting, and there again, first time, I had some good shots, but I didn't get any pheasants, but it didn't take me long, maybe two hunts before I got my first pheasant, but I really enjoyed that. One time, Daryl and Craig and I were hunting, and I don't remember where we were, but we'd stopped to rest, and a couple of hunters came across the fence into the field we were in, but they were 200 or 300 yards away from us, and they climbed over the fence, and they jumped two pheasants. And one of them flew right towards me, and they both shot. The hunters down there shot at him, but they didn't get him. But this one pheasant came right towards me. And I just told the kids, I says, don't move. We just stood absolutely still till it got within range, and I got it, one shot. Craig went running and yelling to get that pheasant. Another pheasant hunt we had, we frequently went pheasant hunting out in the Roosevelt area. Alva Snow was our friend out there, and he wouldn't go. He was a stake president, so he wouldn't go hunting with us on Sunday, which we did once in a while, but he'd go with us on Saturday, and he knew where to go, and we always had good success. And I have a picture of LeVar Bateman and I with a whole string of pheasants. I don't remember the year or anything about it, but it was a good hunt. Oh, I remember one hunt out there at LeVar. And Harold Poole, Alvis Snow, and myself had been hunting quite a while. It was noontime, so we were carrying a lunch, and we decided we'd stop at the corner of this field and eat. So we did. We sat there talking and visiting and eating our lunch, and after we had a good rest, well, let's go see if we can get some birds. None of us had 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 some shots, but nobody had killed a bird. And so we got up, picked up our guns. We hadn't gone three steps when a pheasant flew up right in front of us. That bird had not been 5 yards away from where we were sitting, and it had sat there all the time we were eating and visiting. And when it flew up, Harold didn't aim his gun. He just shot from the hip, and he hit that bird right square in the body, and it exploded. We found the feet, and we found the head and feathers, and that's all we found. And it was just instinctive. He didn't think about it. No, you think about it, you wait for the bird to get out far enough away from you that you've got a good shot at it, but he just instinctively shot from the waist, from the hip. When we lived in Lehigh, the high priests in the 70s would go rabbit hunting on New Year's Day with the elders and the Adelderonic, and they count the rabbits that they each killed, and the loser had to put on a banquet for the winners and their spouses. And we went out to the Skull Valley area, and the high priests in the 70s would get to one end of the valley, and the elders and the Adelderonic would get the other end, and then we'd walk toward each other. When we got fairly close, then we'd close the ends of it in till we had a circle. And when we'd made a circle, you couldn't shoot in the circle. You had to wait for the rabbit to break through the outside so that nobody got hurt. So that was fun. And everybody would pull off the rabbit tail, and then at the end of the hunt, we'd count the rabbit tails. And the loser had to put on the banquet, and the losers, most of the time, were the high priests, whose wives were better cooks anyway, more experienced, I better say. And we had a nice banquet. And one year, they outdid themselves. The banquet was wonderful. The food was delicious, but the decorations were superb. What they had done was they had these church tables all put together in long rows and covered them with white newsprint. And down the center, they'd put a dark gray crepe paper with crinkled edges about 12 inches wide. And then on top of the crepe paper, they had sagebrush. And scattered through the sagebrush were chocolate-covered raisins. Oh, that was hilarious. I don't remember any other decorations or dinners even. I do remember that Vivian had to help put some on when the elders and high priests, elders and Deuteronomic lost. And then when we moved to Sandy, we started a New Year's Day tradition. We'd go rabbit hunting on New Year's Day. Harold and his friend Ralph Holding, myself. I took the boys with me many times. I can't think, there were some others that went with us. But anyway, we'd go back out to Skull Valley and hunt rabbits. Had a good time, enjoyable time doing it. I remember when we lived at the Desert Chemical Warfare Depot, we didn't have a lot of money, and we ate the rabbits. We skinned them out and cleaned them out and took them home and ate them. I remember one year going out to Skull Valley to hunt rabbits with our deer rifles. Harold decided that the last year we'd been deer hunting, too many of us had missed. We needed more practice with our deer rifles, so just for practice, we'd go out shooting rabbits because it was legal to shoot rabbits year-round. And we'd shoot them with our deer rifles, would get us into shape so we could hit a deer when we saw it. We wounded some rabbits, and we killed some where they would stop and stand up and look at us, and we'd killed some. But I was the only one that hit a running rabbit, and it exploded like Uncle Harold's pheasant did. 30-06 bullet hitting a rabbit. One of our trips, and I can't remember which one, but the whole family was in the car, and we were on a dirt road going somewhere, and a rabbit came across the road, and I stopped the car and got my revolver out, and all the boys were shooting, saying, "Shoot it, Daddy, shoot it, shoot it." And the girls were yelling, "Run, buddy, run, buddy." That was fun. We had a lot of fun as a family. I was never much of a fisherman. I concluded the fish were smarter than I was, so there's no point in my bothering them. And we were up at Moon Lake as a family vacation. And we were in a boat. Daryl was holding the fishing pole, and a fish took the bait. And Daryl looked at me, and I says, "Give me the rod, son, I'll reel it in." And I've regretted that all of my life, why I didn't say, "Daryl, start reeling it in and let him catch the fish." I really felt badly about that. In my old age, I've had to give up hunting, which has bothered Craig. So he's put my name in for a wild turkey hunt, along with his and Clay's. Guess who drew out? I'm the one that drew out, so I had to go turkey hunting with Craig. We went down to south central Utah somewhere, and I have no idea where. parked the truck and got out. Craig has a turkey call, and every once in a while we'd stop and he'd rattle this thing. And we heard some turkeys. Some of them we thought we were getting to come close to us, but the only one that got close to us was a hen, and we couldn't shoot hens. You had to shoot the male turkeys, so we didn't get anything that time. And so the next weekend we go down again, and we're going down early in the morning. All of a sudden, we're going up this dirt road, and Craig slammed the brakes on. He says, "Look, Dad, there in the big tree ahead of us, we could see 5 or 6 turkeys roosting for the night." And he says, "Pick one of those out and shoot it." And I said, "Well, how am I going to know whether it's a hen or not?" He says, "The big ones are the roosters." And he said, that, any one of those. And he said, "They're a standing target. Just take your time and get one of them." So I took my time, and I aimed very carefully, and I missed. And the turkey I was shooting at might have been wounded a little bit, because instead of flying away, it dropped right to the ground and ran. It was just barely getting light. Craig and I ran after it, but we never did see it again. And I wasn't the most excited hunter in the world anyway at that age, so I told Craig, that was 3 or 4 years ago, I was over 80. And so I told Craig that I'd sit in the truck and read, and he could take the gun and see what he can. He came back with a turkey. Craig and Colleen's family ate it. We had a piece. It was good, really good. I enjoyed it, thought it was great. Craig's talking now about taking me deer hunting with him. He says he's got a tent now that has 2 rooms, both with their own private doors, and you can have your own room and a cot to sleep in. I don't know, I may or may not go. One time I took Brad and Craig with me on a hunt on the backside of Mount Timpanogos. It was a postseason hunt, and a buck or doe was available, and you could shoot either one. And we got up and drove up early, went, got above Aspen Grove, where the road takes off to, what's the name of the springs up there? I can't think of the name. Anyway, instead of going on the Alpine Loop around Timpanogos and down American Fork Canyon, there's a road that goes towards Colville to some springs. Anyway, we camped on that, or parked on that road, and we got spread out somehow. Anyway, I was sitting down, resting. I was tired. And I heard something. I looked around, and here came this deer just picking its way through the oak brush. And I waited till it got about 30 yards from me and shot it. And I was the only one that got a deer that year, and I had done the least work. I'd hiked the least. but I remember dragging it back to the truck, Craig and Brad helping me. And later on, later hunts, I remember Brad saying how nice it was to have these motor scooters that they take hunting now, these motorizers. Yeah.